Chapter 19. The King in Yellow. That nightmare I had, weeks ago, about performing naked on stage at the Albert Hall in front of an audience of empty police uniforms? Too realistic for comfort. The nascent sense of panic is chokingly familiar. There's no escape through waking up this time around. As I walk out onto the stage, past the percussion, then forward to the strings, I can't see the audience. We're lit brightly from above, but the whistles and chatter and applause and the crackle of party poppers all take place beyond the footlights. There's a burst of clapping as I walk towards the front, and the odd appreciative wolf whistle. The other musicians are in formal concert black, the soloists in evening gowns and tuxes, our conductor in white tie and tails. My superhero drag marks me out as if I was naked. There is a music stand waiting for me. Jim stands stiffly beside it, perspiration glistening on his forehead. The other violinists look at me with ill-concealed incredulity as an announcer hurries up to the conductor, and they confer quietly. I can't break out of this walking nightmare, however hard I try. I find my hands are full, busily unlocking my violin case and extracting the bow and body without my conscious volition getting a look in. Fuck it, Mary, where are you? Why aren't you here? I glance at Jim. Maybe I can talk to him. Jim? He doesn't make eye contact. He looks slightly glassy, swaying in place as if anchored to the ocean floor in the grip of a watery current. Another gish. Jim, snap out of it. His hand reaches out towards the music stand, adjusts the somewhat tattered brown-covered score that waits for me, and Lecter snarls, triumphant. The young, incredibly pretty, and astonishingly talented soloist who carried me away with her brilliance during the first half. She's barely 20 and she's already better than I'll ever be. Leans towards me and peers at my instrument in perplexity.
Who made this?
She asks, raising one perfectly threaded eyebrow.
I haven't seen one of these before.
I manage to tear my eyes away from the cover of the score and stare at her.
If you value your life, run!
I hiss at her and she recoils, eyes wide.
I mean it. Get out now before it's too late.
I raise my bow and lay it across Lecter's strings, and he responds, just a faint ripple of lightning blue running up and down the fingerboard, which is incredibly sensitive tonight.
Who are you?
She asks. Trafalgar Square, the mayor, remember? Things are going to break bad. Get as many people out as you can. The lights are going down on the audience, and the background of noise changes. Jim is still swaying slightly, and after a moment, I realise he isn't blinking. Faint tear tracks run down his cheeks, but that's an autonomic reflex.
If you've done anything to him,
I warn Lecter, I'll...
Not me.
Lecter sounds awfully smug.
Play now?
His anticipation fills me with an awful, dull foreboding. Beside the conductor, the announcer clears his throat, then raises a cordless microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to announce a change of programme for the second half.
He pauses. You could hear a pin drop. Changes of programme are not normal during the last night of the proms.
We will, of course, be concluding the evening as usual with a round of Rule Britannia, then Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March No. 1 in D Major, Jerusalem, and the National Anthem. But first, we have something very special for you tonight. It has never been played before in a concert hall. Indeed. The score of this piece was thought to have been lost until barely a month ago, A copy came to light in the Rare Manuscripts archive during the clean-up, after the mad scientist Professor Freudstein's robbery of the British Library. Some of you may have heard of a famously obscure play called The King in Yellow. It was in part the subject of a television crime drama last year. The King in Yellow was converted to an opera but never performed in full. Franz Kafka prepared the libretto, and a score was subsequently written by his collaborator, the violinist Erich Zahn, for performance on specially adapted instruments of his own devising. But the rise of fascism put an end to all attempts to perform it until after the war. During the early 1960s, Delia Derbyshire of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop attempted to rescore the concerto for electronic instruments. But the controversial nature of the piece resisted attempts to bring it to a mainstream audience. Until now, that is. With the recovery of the original score, we are delighted to present, for the first time, the extraordinary violin sonata from the second act that marked the zenith of Erich Zahn's career. Our special guest soloist for tonight is Dr. Dominique O'Brien, lecturer in music at Birkbeck College, who is not only a leading authority on atonality in modernist composition during the Weimar period, but a talented soloist in her own right, and one of the few musicians who performs with an original Zahn instrument. Accompanying her on percussion, wind, and brass is the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, while elements of the text will be narrated as prose by... Jim reaches out jerkily, as if not in control of his own arm muscles, and turns back the cover to reveal the first page. My nerveless feet shuffle sideways, positioning me before the stand. I turn to face the invisible audience, wishing that my own superpower would manifest right now and vanish me from their purview, wishing the very earth would open up beneath my feet and swallow me. My guts are loose with fear. This is not stage fright, but something far, far worse. The sum of all my nightmares. I can't stop myself. I read the bracketed staves of the first line, see how the movement begins with the wind section, and where I am supposed to come in. A will not my own compels me to seat my instrument properly between shoulder and chin, and pushing past my terror, brushing my pathetic resistance aside, Lecter takes control of my wrists and fingertips. My traitor hands begin to play. I have been playing the violin since I was 8 years old, and I've practiced virtually every day with Lecter for the past decade. I've published papers on the intersection of music theory and occult inference systems. I came to the attention of the laundry for my research, and the Black Chamber too. So I know whereof I speak, when I say that music has power. I also know what I'm on about when I assert, with some certainty, that while I am a reasonably proficient musician, I am in no way up to the standard of a guest soloist performing before the last night audience at the Albert Hall. Third violin, maybe, at a pinch. If I really worked at it, and the orchestra director was hard up for talent. On the other hand, I'm probably the only violinist in the country who can both sight-read the particular score in front of me and understand what it's saying on all levels. The musical phrasing and the deeper expressions it invokes. The first page is light enough. An introduction in a minor key that gives me time to warm up. But soon enough, Jim turns the page before me, and we're into a much stronger exposition. Two themes, alternating from F minor to D flat major, with a subtext that makes my skin crawl and itch, as if tiny insects are burrowing beneath the surface, for I recognize the pattern of an invocation when I see one. My instrument's strings glow almost invisibly in the spotlight glare, but I can feel Lecter's power gathering in a rush as he awakens. From the corner of one eye,
I can just see the soprano soloist taking breath as she prepares to give voice to Casilda's lament, beside the turbid waters of the Lake of Hali.
My turn,
Lecter hums, overwhelmingly satisfied, like a gigantic predator that is gathering himself to pounce on the fattest, juiciest prey. What will this do? I can't stop reading. My fingers refuse to still themselves. The gesh has me enchained. But sight reading doesn't quite take all my attention.
I return to myself thus wise.
I glimpse a vision through the eyes of Lecter's interior space. And it is truly frightening. The stony amphitheatre of my earlier dream is superimposed over the stage of the Royal Albert Hall. The ceiling has disappeared, revealing a clear sky pierced by the lights of 1,000 alien stars. Around me, an orchestra of the dead plays for an audience of the damned.
Who are you?
Lecter laughs. The madness of strings.
I am an echo of an echo, ripped from yellowing bones, enrobed in shrouds, to dance within this rigid body. Do you know me yet?
The violin in my hands feels alive by proxy. As the piece moves back to the major theme, I feel him, warm and pulsing with stolen life, all the lives he's drunk down over the years and decades since the mad luthier of Munich bound a summoned demon into an instrument carved from the still raw bones of human sacrifices. Are you the king in yellow? I demand, as Jim, somnambulant, turns the page, and our little songbird at the podium raises her voice in song.
I am no more the king in yellow than your littlest fingernail is the bearer of the white violin. But soon.
Then, the development steps up a level, and I can't spare any attention for horrified contemplation. My fingers and hands and arms and upper body are all caught up in the progression, as the chorus join in song, chanting lyrics increasingly mutilated and warped to serve the ends of Freudstein. Strange is the night, where black stars rise, and strange moons circle through the skies. But stranger still is lost Carcosa. Songs of law the Hyades shall sing, where flap the tatters of the king, must die unheard in dim Carcosa. Bind those who hear these words to love the law, though death itself shall die. Unquestioning, obedient, in dim Carcosa. The Albert Hall has completely disappeared. I seem to stand amidst a frozen orchestra as the music dies away around us. Jim is frozen beside the music stand, a puppet in the hands of a tired master. His eyes glow faintly with the spiralling worm sign of feeders in night. The audience, on the stone steps of the amphitheatre, are familiar. Promgoers, transported bodily to the alien place, immobile in the grip of some force that has stopped time itself. I look up at where the ceiling should be, and see moons. Two of them, shining down like symbols of merciless alienation. My hands are empty. I jerk round, half-panicked, a sense of helpless vulnerability. I know in retrospect this sounds laughable. Gripping me. Because the violin is my most powerful defence and Lecter vanished just as I found myself on this stony stage. But then I realise what's going on.
Looking for me?
I dry swallow, looking up at Lecter's true form. Not really, I say, in a very small voice, trembling slightly.
Too bad.
In this place, Lecter doesn't wear the body of a bone-white violin,
He doesn't need to. I know where we are. Previously, he's invaded my dreams, but now flushed with the power of a major summoning, he's dragged me into his dream. Now I know what to look for. I can feel ghost fingers moving, the tension of neck and shoulder betraying a performance still in progress.
I couldn't risk you refusing to cooperate further with my little joke.
The gaunt figure, floating in mid-air before me, seems to smirk, even though its face is hidden from my perception by a veil of palest golden lace.
So, I thought I'd invite you backstage with me, while your body plays on without you.
This is where you live, isn't it? I glance away. Around us, the frozen figures stand, row upon row, eyes flickering with tainted phosphorescence. This is where you've always been.
I'm the last one, you know. The last surviving key. All the other violins are lost, destroyed, or locked away. All but me.
Yes. I turn back to face him. It. Him. The avatar of that which the pale violins were created to summon, when the stars were right. Lecter's shadow, the king in yellow, released from captivity within the body of the bone violin. There are people who really don't think you should exist anymore. Did you know that?
I am aware.
His amusement is icy.
But once the key turns in the lock, I shall come into my full birthright, and they will cease to be of concern.
Here I stand, trapped timeless in the gap between two beats of a measure, in a work of transcendental melodic magic that has been perverted into a summoning. Here I stand, caught inside the dreamscape of my own cursed musical instrument, while it seeks to pervert the perversion, to turn Operation Freudstein's insanely dangerous attempt at a mass gesh of compulsion into an invocation instead. A summoning for the King in Yellow. Here I stand, outside of time and space. And I notice that I'm shaking. I'm not in shock, and I am not cold, for there is no temperature in Lecter's dream. I am, I slowly realise, livid with anger and just barely bottling it in. Anger? Rage, actually. Let me enumerate the roots of my rage. I'm furious with Bob for deserting me to become the new eater of souls. I'm mortified and angry with myself for falling for Jim's charms while failing to realise that he'd been placed in my organisation, whether or not he knew it, by our adversary, to provide them with a continuous stream of intelligence about us via his weekly reports. Even before we come to my abduction into this waking nightmare, I was furious at my instrument for daring to tiptoe around my dreams and hopes and fears, resentful of the way it manipulated me with Mary. I'm pissed off at Dr. Armstrong for dumping me into the directorship at Incorrigible, also known as the Transhuman Police Coordination Force, a job for which I am absolutely inadequate and unqualified. But above and beyond that, I am disgusted with him for knowingly putting me in a position of assumed helplessness in hope that it would lead our enemy to play their hand. Despite being fully aware of my history of what unquiet ghosts it would dredge up. I'm upset at myself for being afraid of standing backlit against windows and for spooking at loud noises in crowds. I'm angry with all the waiters and shop assistants and police foot patrols who can look right at me and fail to see me as I slowly drown in the oceanic waters of social irrelevance, succumbing to the invisibility of the middle-aged woman until it gradually becomes a 3 or 4 sigma superpower, an expression of my own not inconsiderable strength as a practitioner feeding on my sense of self-doubt
and inadequacy. The Invisible Man is a Walesian supervillain, but the Invisible Women are all around us, anxious and unseen. I lack the words to adequately express how incensed I am by the activities of Deputy Commissioner Laura Stanwyck of the Metropolitan Police and her cronies within ACPO, who have decided on their own initiative that Nanny knows best, and that creating a nightmare supervillain as a stalking horse to justify raping 20 million minds in parallel is a perfectly acceptable price to pay. If it improves cooperation with the police in a time of national crisis. A crisis that they barely understand and are in no small measure unintentionally contributing to by diverting our scarce resources. That the culmination of Operation Freudstein is an attempt to compel millions of people to obey the rules of policing is bad enough. That they've recklessly chosen to ignore my urgent warnings about the risks of overfeeding the white violin is worse. That the instrument in question sees this as an opportunity to become the undead avatar of the King in Yellow, and is well on the way to doing just that, if I'm any judge of demonic summonings gone wrong, is just unspeakable. But all of this is displacement. The harsh fact is, I don't much like who I've become or what I've done with my life since I followed Bob down the rabbit hole of the laundry all those years ago. I have, admittedly, had all those extra years of life and even some stretches of something approximating marital bliss. I can't forget the way Bob rescued me twice from fates that don't bear thinking about. Admittedly, I returned the favour. We've played a hair-raisingly extreme version of For Better or For Worse over the years. But it's been crumbling for ages now, as I was sent on one nightmarish job after another, culminating in Vakilabad and then the nonsense in Trafalgar Square. History repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. I've sacrificed a lot to the laundry. I allowed my academic career to wither, marking time in a teaching niche. Kids? Well, they were a non-starter once I understood the horrifying implications of Case Nightmare Green. Salary? Don't get me started. I'm in my 40s now. My best years behind me, marriage coming unravelled, career tanking spectacularly. And when the chips were down, the oath of office I swore rendered me unable to say no to the most heinously immoral order anyone has ever given me. My self-respect has taken a battering from these successive betrayals of trust. But I'm still angry. And as long as I'm not numb, I've got something to work with. And more to the point, I think Lecter has inadvertently given me a way out. There is this thing about my oath of office. I'm sworn to the defence of the realm, and I'm sworn to obey lawful orders. That's the horrible thing about Laura Stanwyck's having served me with notice under Part 2 of the Civil Contingencies Act, signed by the Home Secretary, after the SA helpfully seconded me to the Home Office. It's entirely lawful, because the CCA is essentially an enabling act that allows designated emergency commanders to make it up as they go along. It was designed to ensure continuity of operations in event of a major catastrophe, such as a nuclear war, and I'm helpless to refuse it, because the gesh built into my oath of office requires me to obey lawful orders. But the sorcerers who devised the gesh weren't stupid. I have some latitude in how I interpret an order. Laura Stanwyck ordered me to go on stage with the white violin and play the sonata from The King in Yellow before a live audience. But she didn't order me to help Lecter unlock the astral gate and summon his master. That's the instrument's agenda, not the Home Office at work. And more prosaically, she forgot to order me not to do anything else. In that frozen moment, standing in the middle of the amphitheatre of dreams in Lecter's memory of long-lost Carcosa, I realise what I have to do. I draw on what willpower I have and slip sideways, away from even this shadow of reality. Lecter's spectral outline shifts, drifting towards me. I take a step back, then another.
Where have you gone?
I can feel my invisibility like a cloak I can tug around myself. I take a step sideways, towards Jim's frozen image. The glowing eyes. He's not possessed yet, not quite. He's just open to possession. If Lecter comes into his full power and erupts, unleashing a tidal wave of hunger across the stage. I reach around his shoulders and shroud him in my imaginary cloak.
What are you doing? Reveal yourself at once.
A voice of thunder rattles from the stone steps around us, hammering my ears. Jim's body is rigid as stone, stiff, unbreathing in this place, an instant between heartbeats. The thing that is Lecter pounds away across the stage, bowling through the oboes and clarinets like a vengeful fury, scattering mannequin musicians in all directions.
Come back!
He howls, distracted. Good. I can't feel my fingers properly. That's also a good sign. It means the illusion he's woven to trap me here is slipping slightly. I lean in close, towards Jim's face. Jim, wake up! Snap out of it! Something changes. He doesn't move, doesn't respond. But after a moment, I realise he's breathing. Trapped in this place with me outside time. Jim! If this were a fairy tale, I'd have to kiss him or something. But, unfortunately, the real world is a whole lot more complicated. And I am not going there until Officer Friendly and I have had a free and frank exchange of opinions about loyalty. So instead, I kick him on the right shin. Hard.
Ow!
Jim staggers, the luminosity fading from his eyes.
Ah! Ow! Mo, where are... Get down!
I grab him again, stretching my shroud, and drag him to the ground as Lecter howls and shrieks overhead, blotting out the moons as he flies across the arena.
Where are... Shut up!
I hiss. It takes concentration to extend my imaginary cloak around others, but I've done it before. I did it for Busy Bee in Downing Street. I can do it for Jim here. Listen, we're awake in Lecter's dreamscape. Stanwyck thinks if I play this sonata with the modified lyrics, she can turn a third of the population into obedient little constables. Lecter has other ideas, and if I finish it, we're in a world of hurt. That... There is a pale silver ovoid glimmering in the air at the far side of the stage. A portal of a kind I've seen before and really don't want to be seeing here. Is Lecter attempting to summon his superior avatar, the King in Yellow? Oh shit, is that... Yes, shut up. In a moment you're going to wake up on stage again and you've got to stop me playing, do you understand? I grab his shoulders, wrap my arms around him. I stare into his eyes and see the confusion bleed away, replaced by worried concern. Mo, can't you... Laura hit me with a gash. Do you know the story, The Red Shoes? Someone else has to stop me. But I... He looks sick. I'm really sorry. I had no idea she was planning... Another mournful howl splits the air. Lecter soars high above the ruins of Carcosa, searching for his runaway host. You want me to stop you playing? Got it, I say. And try not to use your superpowers. If you use them here, it could be really bad. That would attract the feeders, like sending up an occult signal saying, K-syndrome fast food Buffy here. He's hugging me back. And because we're trapped between ticks of the clock in a dream of desolate ruins, I lean close to him, a and kiss him on the lips once, by way of a goodbye. And as I feel him respond, we fade to standing spotlit on a stage, wrists and shoulders feeling pierced by hot wires and blood trickling down my stinging fingertips to lubricate the blue humming strings of the white violin, as I face the music in the Albert Hall, the bow dragging my hand back and forth as the tempo increases and the chorus raise their voices in an unearthly counterpoint.
Found you.
Lecter shrieks inside my head as my right ring finger buzzes emphatically, and I sense, rather than see, a great tattered bat shape flapping towards me out of the darkness beyond the lights. Then Jim makes his move, and all hell breaks loose. For a split second, Jim stands beside me, white-gloved, hand hovering over the corner of the score from which my bleeding hands are compelled to play. Then he grabs the manuscript and jumps. I told him not to, but of course, silly me, my mojo is all about being ignored. I gape, following his leap. Any lingering doubt that Jim is indeed officer friendly vanishes after him as I follow his trajectory towards the dress circle boxes.
Come back!
Lecter howls in my head, deafening me. But the gesh is broken. With no musical score, I can't continue the performance. I slowly turn towards the orchestra, lowering my bow as a steady trickle of blood runs down the fingerboard of my instrument and splatters to the floor. There's something wrong with the bow, I realise dimly. My finger vibrates again, an urgent imperative. Faces look at me. And these eyes are indeed glowing, writhing blue-green worms twirling within the heads of people who no longer exist in any human sense of the word. The instrument feels dead. It feels like a violin made of bone. The anima that gave it such a vibrant sense of life has departed. No. It's not dead. Rather, I'm keeping an iron grip on my own visibility because something in the back of my head is terrified that Lecter will notice me again. I've blocked him out completely. As long as he can't see me, his attention will be turned elsewhere. But that might not be a good thing. All around me stand the bodies of orchestra and proms goers, occupied by the lesser feeders in the night for whom the recital has opened the way. Mindless processes of contagion and possession that swirl in the wake of the greater summonings and seek living bodies to run on. Allowed to swarm in because Laura Stanwyck wouldn't take no for an answer and didn't let me fully explain the risks of a recital with the white violin so close to breaking loose. And in a moment, they're going to realise that I'm not one of them. The words oh and dear spring to mind. I often find myself wishing for my husband, most frequently for trivial reasons ranging from mere comforting conversation to kitchen sink side assistance. But right now, I could really use him. If Bob was here, putting down an incursion of a few thousand hungry feeders in the night would be a non-problem. That's the sort of thing the Eater of Souls does. Again, if things stood as they did 6 months ago, when I was still in control of my instrument and Lecter damn well did as he was told, this would be a non-problem. But not only am I no longer with my husband, I am hiding from my instrument's attention because he seems intent on turning me into a tool of his own will. So, I appear to be stranded in the middle of a zombie mosh pit with a thousand or more feeder-possessed bodies, a numb violin, a dysfunctional superhero costume, and only my own talent to fall back on. I just hope the feeders aren't paying attention to the bat signal right now, because if they are, I'm done for. Tightening my invisibility around me like a cloak, I carefully step sideways towards the soloist's seat. I'm really glad to see that she listened to me and left. I think I can do this. The possessed are still focused on where I stood a moment ago, and they're not actually moving. Maybe they can't see me. No, they're tracking me. Or rather, they're tracking the thing I'm carrying. They're tracking Lecter. This goes beyond an oh dear moment. I analyse my options, and this is what I get. I can get out of here on my own. They can't see me any more than anyone else who I don't want to be seen by can see me. But if I scuttle away, I'll be leaving several thousand promgoers in thrall to whatever brain-eating parasites Lecter has invited to the party. I'll also be leaving a truly hideous mess for the first responders when they arrive on scene. What I should do is try to banish them. But I can't do that without my instrument's cooperation. Or can I? I look up at the shadowy recesses of the ceiling. Jim's up there somewhere, isn't he? He took the score. I can only hope he's got the sense to run away, that the feeders didn't notice him, and that the high-power ward I upgraded him to is strong enough to protect him as long as Lecter can't see him directly. My belt pouch vibrates. A moment later, the ring on my right hand contracts painfully, pulsing twice. This had better be important. I reach into my pouch and quickly glance at my phone. There's a text message from Mary. My knees go weak. We're coming in. Can you distract them? I tap out a reply with shaking fingers. We'll try. I hit send, then shove my phone back in the pouch and look around. The second violin sits slumped forward, eyes glowing. Her instrument has fallen at her feet, unnoticed. I pick up her stand and score. My fingertips feel as if they've been burned, and I leave a reddish smear on everything I touch, especially the papers. Careful not to brush up against any of the possessed, I pick my way past the immobile players and walk towards the concert grand parked at the side of the stage. I'm in luck. The lid is down. The pianist not yet on stage to play his part of the programme. I climb onto the stool, then boost myself up onto the top of the horribly expensive instrument, trying not to think about what my boots are doing to its finish, but for what I'm going to do next. I need a raised platform with a good view in all directions, the better to see my audience. I set up the stand, open the score, and raise my instrument. Mine, not Lecter's. It's still the same bone-white body, made from materials nobody in their right mind would inquire too closely about. But there's no sense of his attention hovering around it. Lecter, the entity bound into the body, is elsewhere right now. No time to check whether this is safe. I've just got to hope that it works. I flip through the score, looking for what I need. Stanwyck's inadvisable editing of the second half of the night's programme replaced a medley of popular pieces with The King in Yellow. But she didn't touch the traditional closing sequence. Even to a manipulative Philistine like her, rearranging the traditional end of the last night concert qualifies as sacrilege or treason or both. So I cut straight to the climax. First up in the sequence is Ansel's Plymouth Hoe, a nautical overture. But there's precious little I can do with it with just one violin. I could run through the main theme, but it's light on strings and heavy on the brass and winds. So I flip past it and go straight to Rule Britannia. Now that's scored for strings. I'll have to improvise a bit, and I can't count on any support from the chorus, who are peering green-eyed and silent in the direction of Lecter's body. But it's really hard to mess up something so deeply ingrained in anyone who learned violin in a British secondary school. It's traditionally followed by Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, March No. 1 in D minor, better known as Land of Hope and Glory. Then Jerusalem. The proms are really big on Elgar. Finishing with the national anthem. This had better be worth it, Mary, I mutter. I'm terrified that I'm going to get this wrong. That's what comes of paying too much attention to my own fear and self-doubt. I've got to do this, got to get it right the first time. I take a deep breath and I start to play, my fingertips sore and bleeding across strings that remain stubbornly dark. The sound of one violin playing in a concert venue the size of the Albert Hall is a lonely thing. But there is none of the usual quiet side chat, shuffling and laughter you'd expect from a regular audience. As I begin, you could hear a pin drop. Normally, the audience would be on their feet, brandishing banners and singing along with the lead soloist and the BBC chorus. It's the nearest thing you'll get to an American-style display of hyper-patriotic flag-waving from the normally reticent British. But this isn't a normal concert audience. As I play, I look around at my audience. They're cold. Cold as the grave. Thousands of pairs of pale green glowing eyes focus on the thing in my hands. Their bodies standing immobile. Trapped within shells of flesh. I can't even tell if they're still alive or if their souls have already been eaten. Part of me is still concentrating on my invisibility, fearful that if I relax my focus, Lecter will notice me. If he wins again, I'll have to play. And I won't be able to stop until my hands are bleeding stumps, no longer able to hold bow to string. Heads begin to turn, one by one at first. Then, in a wave of iridescence that flashes across the floor of the hall. Something is happening behind me, but I don't dare look round. I have to keep the music flowing. But it's hard to concentrate on playing and to withhold myself from visibility at the same time. The need to remain unseen is the antithesis of the performative impulse.
Stop it. Stop it now.
Lecter has finally noticed me. My fingertips burn as the strings and bow light up with blue-green fire, spiraling whorls of light that echo the gaze of the possessed. Is it my imagination? Or does he sound frightened? Querulous? Not going to stop. I hum quietly along to the score.
You must not do this. Where is the score? Where has he taken it?
Don't know. Don't care. We're going to finish this lecture. We're going to bring this back to the last night of the proms, and you're going to make all your little friends go away. Somehow, I managed to flip the page without smearing blood all over it.
I've won, you know.
The voice in my head bleeds menace.
Eat them all.
If you eat the audience, I can promise you an eternity of torment. The auditors won't stop me. You can go too far, you know. Before me, the audience sway gently. One by one, they begin to raise their arms. I don't dare to hope they're possessed after all. This might just be Lecter directing them to act in unison. But I feel his attention drifting from me. No, something is wrong. Something I didn't anticipate. But what? At first, I think the stage lights are coming up, but then I realise the shadow of my leg stretching out before me is being cast from a single source, directly behind me, rather than overhead. I turn to face the light and falter, recover, then force myself to keep playing even though I desperately want to flee.
Carcosa,
Lecter tells me.
Where the king in yellow waits.
It's a gate. Circular. Perhaps 5 meters in diameter, its rim burning with a pale limelight fire as it stretches across the stage in front of the organist's pit. Beyond it, I see a shadowy stage. Dreadfully familiar rows of cracked stone seats rising up in the amphitheatre beyond. Other performers on stage. White shrouded, their features invisible as they dance and sway to inaudible music, performed at the command of one who has not yet come. With a barely audible sigh, the first rank of the possessed audience collapse in windrows, their glowing eyes simultaneously extinguished. The ward I wear around my neck stings my skin, heating up painfully. The gate ripples, then firms up.
Mau!
A shrill voice shouts behind me.
Hold on!
I stare at the gate, horrified. As the bubbling laughter and triumph of the strings rises from between my fingers and my nerveless hands continue to pull notes from the white violin without any conscious volition on my part. All I can do is watch as Lecter rips the life from bodies by the thousand, pouring it into the opening he's carved in space-time. I can feel something else on the other side of the gate respond. A dreadful sense of recognition as an echo of Lecter's attention turns my way. I want to stop my hands moving, but they won't do what I command. Is this my fault? Part of me wonders as I fail to make the music stop before the thing on the other side answers the call of its smallest part. The fingernail scraping bound and bone that is Lecter. Something slams into me from behind, throwing me bodily off the top of the piano. For a split second I'm falling, but then I land, and someone cushions my collapse. In a blurring moment, I'm surrounded by B, interposing her hands between my elbows, knees, head, and floor. Somehow I'm still holding the violin in one hand and the bow in the other. Still glowing blue-green. So intense that they leave after-images when I glance at them. What? I manage to say, then my arms are trying to raise the instrument and set bow to string. But it's really hard to play the fiddle when your shoulders give a painful wrench and your wrists are suddenly handcuffed. Don't fight, B pants in my ear. There's a huge weight on my back, and after a moment I realise it's Captain Marvelous. I'm being sat on by my own minion. Wonderful.
Mary.
Here, Moe. She jumps across fallen chairs and lands beside me, the two halves of the violin case in her hands.
Can you put it in?
Too strong,
I gasp.
Won't hold it. Also,
I nod towards the gate.
Well, all the same.
Mary cringes back from the fiddle, which is trying to poke her.
Who can...
Coming,
calls Ramona.
Wait for me.
The whine of her wheelchair sets my teeth on edge like a dentist's drill as she rises and flies above the field of bodies. For a moment the glamour slips, and I see it as it is, and wish I hadn't. Those aren't wheels, and her chariot is disturbingly alive. But then it descends to the stage, and I blink, and it's a wheelchair again.
You can't stop me!
Lecter roars. I try to let go again, but all that happens is my hands twitch helplessly.
Wrong!
Ramona throws something to Mary.
Warded gloves! B, go and help Lollipop and Torch. Eric, see if you can work that thing out of her hands. Mary, hold the case while Eric closes it. Then shove it over here while I... Slaves to me!
I've been dreading this moment. All around us, the possessed are rising. Those who haven't already been life-drained by Lecter. But they're not going to human wave us. Rather, they're bunching up, opening corridors to the back of the floor, where I see other bodies with green glowing eyes that almost match the luminosity of their high-vis vests. Of course. Lecter's had over an hour to work on Laura's people, hasn't he?
Get off me,
I gasp.
Soz, not going to happen until you let go, boss.
Some unseen force tugs at my fingers as Eric, Captain Marvelous, shifts his weight. My ribs creak. Then suddenly my fingertips close on air.
Great. Is it in?
There's a loud clatter as the bone violin and its bow skitter into the case that Mary holds warily at arm's length. She slams it shut, then fumbles the catches closed.
In the bag.
Mary sounds exhausted.
You can let her up now.
Sorry, Mo.
She turns and shoves the case across the stage. I can still feel Lecter in my head, buzzing furiously. But he's curiously muffled. Eric rolls off me and apologetically produces a handcuff key. I raise my wrists.
Jesus, boss, what happened to your hands?
He asks. I look past his shoulder as he unlocks the cuffs. Behind you! Because I'm watching the approaching cops with the green glowing eyes and their raised batons, I am looking away at the moment when Ramona runs her chair at the violin case and sends it skidding across the stage and through the gate to Carcosa. Even though I know it's for the best, the memory of losing my instrument forever fills me with an unrelieved sense of grey anguish, even now. Decades ago, I read The Lord of the Rings. I believe Tolkien understood something of that sense of loss, from his description of the Ringbearer's torment at the edge of the Crack of Doom. It's the anguish born of losing a part of your body, or a chunk of your soul. And like all amputations, it is best for the subject not to watch it with their eyes open. I don't see the violin case skitter across the threshold, but I feel it. A bone-deep ache in my hands and heart that spreads rapidly.
Come back!
The voice is muffled, but I can still hear him from a great distance. The officers are closing in. There are at least half a dozen of them in crowd control gear. Behind them, another four uniforms, Laura Stanwyck among them. The glowing eyes, is that my perception of them? Or is this something else? They move too normally, too fluidly to be truly possessed, but...
You idiot!
Stanwyck swears, glaring at me.
You had just one job, and you still managed to make a balls up of it. Was that part of your so-called job?
I ask, waving a bloody thumb behind me at the rippling portal.
Because you're under arrest,
she tells me, ignoring the gate floating at the back of the stage. It's as if she can't see it. And yes, her eyes are faintly luminous. What's gotten to her? Backwash from the payload she tried to install on everyone?
We'll work out the charges later, but disobeying orders issued under a CCA note will do for starters. Also, destruction of...
Soon.
My skin crawls as I hear Lecter's call in the distance and an answering echo. Something is approaching the other side of the gate. I can feel it. So, from their behaviour, do the rest of my team. But Stanwyck and her people seem blind to the sense of imminent dread.
Close the fucking gate!
I call, not caring who responds.
Close it down now!
Mary?
On it! Not yet!
An amplified voice booms out. A moment later, the floor beneath me vibrates. I register shock on Stanwyck's face for a split instant, before I look round and see Officer Friendly standing before the gate. In the ghostly moonlight streaming through the portal, the blue strobe light on top of his helmet looks almost washed out. A flickering sapphire of doubt against the forces of night. He's holding a tube of some kind in one hand. I recognise it just as he throws it through the gate, rippling pages unfurling and flapping.
Close it now!
He booms, as I feel something lurch closer. The focus of a malevolence 1,000 times vaster than Lecter searching for. Mary throws something small and dense at the wall of light.
Down!
She shouts, taking a dive towards the floor at one side. I look away and begin to raise my arms to shield my face. Then the high-end banishment ward hits the gate and slices it to shreds, severing my final link with my instrument. And that's all I remember.
So, asks the senior auditor, what happened next?
We're in his office. He's seated behind his desk, chair reclined, a half-full crystal tumbler of smoky amber anesthesia sitting to hand. I'm standing with my back to him, in front of the curtained window, inspecting the weave of the fabric. An expensive, heavy brocade, quite capable of blacking out whatever lies beyond. I'm wearing a cardigan over a baggy dress I can put on and take off without using my fingertips. I'm still on sick leave.
I woke up in hospital, unlike many others. I shoved my gloved hands deeper into my dress's pockets. Slept again. Woke up once for Bob told him to take the damned cat. Another time Jim was there. He wanted to apologize. Said he didn't know about the Freudstein conspiracy. Did you know about him?
Let's keep to your story for now.
He's gentle but ruthless.
What else?
Well, after 3 days they let Mary in to brief me. Or maybe she just walked past the nursing station. It's hard to keep her out of somewhere. She told me about Jim's call. She told me what Jim told her about Assistant Commissioner Stanwyck's operation.
Ex-Assistant Commissioner Stanwyck. He interrupts. I'm sorry, please continue.
Operation Freudstein was the Met's official undercover operation to justify their acquisition of unlimited powers under the Civil Contingencies Act for policing supernormal powers. Coordinating with like-minded chief constables and other forces, with a nod and a wink from the Home Office. Although I think the Home Sec was careful to ensure that she wasn't personally briefed on exactly what they were doing. We were set up to fail, thereby demonstrating that an agency with our background couldn't possibly do the job. Incidentally, if I were you, I'd be really worried about that. Someone in HMG really doesn't love us and want us to be happy. I take a deep breath and turn round and stare at Dr. Armstrong. He nods mildly, looking utterly unperturbed. I lost an irreplaceable asset. The violin, I remind him. I wish he'd be angry so I could be angry right back at him. I trusted a man who was planted on me as a spy. And I nearly allowed it to become a personal betrayal. But the SA doesn't need to know about that side of things. I failed to stop Stanwyck subverting the Gesh in my oath of office, and as a result, I failed to prevent a horrific civilian mass fatality. The death toll at the Royal Albert Hall was lower than I feared at the time, but still well over 2,000. It made news headlines around the world. Blaming it on a deranged supervillain seems somehow inadequate. National trauma ensued. There's popular support for Parliament banning all superpowers. And who could blame them? Even if we know it's really not possible. Any more than a law banning drowning would prevent riptides. The spin-out organisation I set up is almost certainly going to be wound up. Or insourced within the Met as part of the Specialist Operations Directorate. Once they finish cleaning house. Oh, and if I'm really lucky, I may regain enough sensation in my fingertips to play the violin again someday. I allow some tension to creep into my voice as I get to that part. My fingers still ache dully. 4 weeks later, my pain control consultant is gradually tapering off the opiates. Sit down, please, Dr. O'Brien. He gestures at the padded armchair alongside the desk. What do you expect me to say? I expect you to say you're sorry, I say coldly. Well, yes, and you may take that as a given. He glances away as if embarrassed. I take that as my cue to sit down. Do you understand why? Yes. But you knew what it would do to me. He knows about my trust issues. He knows what happened last time someone used me as bait in a trap. Chewed up and spat out. Damaged goods. I know you thought the ends justified the means in this case, Michael. And I can't refute your case. That a major ministry was trying to colonise our turf, using recklessly inappropriate methods. That a very senior police officer was, with approval from the top table, running a rogue paranormal operation. That they'd got in delusions of omniscience and decided that their ends justified their chosen means, regardless of collateral damage, including nearly summoning the King in Yellow. Oh, and they were working with a senior police liaison organisation known for having employed covert intelligence assets to infiltrate other groups. Admittedly, this was at a rather higher level than the usual run-of-the-mill forward intelligence team asset. And Jim wasn't exactly hiding the fact that he was a cop, was he? Nevertheless. I chew my lower lip as he looks at me.
The next sentence will be the hardest. I want to tender my resignation. I say very careful to keep my voice as even as possible. Effective immediately. Then I cross my arms and wait. Dr. Armstrong slides his half-moon glasses off and fumbles on his desk for a cloth.
Excuse me?
I want to quit, I explain. It's too much. I can't. Can't do it. Anymore. My throat doesn't want to obey me. Every time I go back and try harder, it gets worse. It's eaten my life and my friends and my marriage and my hands. And I'm not making things any better. I sniff. I am determined not to cry, but my control is wearing thin. The SA finishes polishing his glasses and puts them back on, then peers at me over their rims.
Have you ever had a nervous breakdown before, Mo?
I have never.
No? I should think not.
He glances at a paper file on his blotter, then reaches into a recess in his desk and pulls out a bottle and an empty glass.
Will you at least join me in a glass?
I stare at the bottle. I don't know what to say, but I shudder violently, and he seems to mistake it for a nod.
You've been driving towards the precipice for the past 18 months, he says. As matter-of-factly, as if he's discussing the weather.
Well, he pours me a glass of Laphroaig.
To be honest, I wasn't sure you'd make it this far. You've been burning the candle at both ends for too long.
He nudges the tumbler towards me. It's so full it nearly slops over.
Cheers.
Cheers. The whiskey is a decent enough single malt, but my sinuses are so clogged with unshed tears that all I can taste is fire water and wood smoke.
What? Nervous breakdowns,
he says very seriously.
Have a lot in common with acute PTSD. You've been courting it for a while. Relationship trouble, overwork, burnout, sleep deprivation, acute stress, and the added burden of,
he swallows,
carrying the white instrument. That's how almost all of us get out of it, incidentally. The violin bleeds you, until you can't handle it anymore. Got out of it, I should say. But it's gone,
I raise my voice. I lost it.
No, Dr. O'Brien, your team made a joint determination that it had become dangerously unstable and decommissioned it before it could kill any more civilians. It nearly killed you, in case you've forgotten. It overpowered you, the second longest-standing bearer, the only one to have custody of it during the active conjunction of Case Nightmare Green.
Who is the longest-standing bearer? I ask before I can stifle my morbid curiosity.
And what happened to him or her? Judy Carroll carried the violin for 9 years back in the 1980s and early 1990s.
I nearly spit single malt across the room.
Grandmotherly Dr. Carroll in her twin set and pearls?
Back before the unfortunate incident at Danzy House, she and I were discussing what to do with the instrument when you could no longer carry it. We had already determined that there were no suitable candidate successors. I believe our biggest dilemma was how to decommission it safely, without provoking an incident along the lines that eventuated at the Albert Hall.
Well, I swallow. I still want to resign.
I know you do. Dr. Armstrong sips his whiskey and frowns at some passing thought as he watches me.
Naturally enough, you feel betrayed and let down right now. And I can't say you're unjustified. You're right about your organization, by the way. I gather they're already opening up a slot on the org chart at the Yard, tentatively labelled SCO-20, Serious Paranormal Crime. They'll purge the management team except for Jim Gray and keep the rank and file on as cadre for the new unit. But that need not concern you. The homesick probably wants my head on a plate, I mumble.
She's not getting it. He leans forward.
Oh, she may have to receive your written pro forma resignation, but
but that's not the same at all. I told you I want to quit.
Yes, well, we can't always get what we want, can we, Mo?
What's that supposed to mean?
It's supposed to mean that we owe you a lengthy stretch of sick leave while you get your head back together. We also owe you a promotion and a performance bonus. Or as much of one as we can scrape together. This isn't the private sector, alas, or you'd be down at Earl's Court pricing up your next luxury yacht. And if it will set your mind at ease, we won't be putting you back into field operations as Agent Candid or anything remotely similar. There's a statute of limitations on field ops, and 8 years of carrying the bone violin means you're fully paid up. After you come back, you won't be punching tentacle monsters anymore. But that doesn't mean the organization is through with you. Quite the contrary, in fact.
His smile is avuncular, warm, friendly, and utterly terrifying.
Your attempt to resign while in the grip of an acute stress reaction is noted and declined. Go home, Mo. Play with the cat. Write up your report. Take a break. Now that the white violin is out of the picture, why don't you see if you can sort things out with your husband? Take a month. Take two. But sooner or later you'll feel better. And when that happens, you should drop in and see me. There are a lot of things we need to talk about. Once you've calmed down and regained your center. For one thing, Judith's seat on the board of auditors is waiting for you. And for another, you know what they say about the traditional reward for a job well done.
The End. This is Elle Newlands. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Annihilation Score by Charles Stross. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, classics, histories and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.